The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Expert advice to keep the whole family healthy at All Care, the largest Irish-owned pharmacy brand.
Good afternoon on this Monday afternoon. How are you? If you want to contact the programme, it's 51551 for texts, or you can send emails to ray@rte.ie. I see that writer, poet, historian and critic Ulic O'Connor has died at the age of 91. I remember Ulic on the Late Late Show back in the 70s and 80s, and they used to have a panel regularly with himself and a guy called Ted Bonner and other people. And what age was I? Well, I was only in my teens, but I remember thinking these men have something to say and they're funny with it. And it was engaging and riveting viewing on a Friday and Saturday night. 91, Ulic O'Connor, may he rest in peace. And there'll be loads of tributes to him, I would imagine, across the day and into tomorrow across RTE1. You heard that headline this morning on it says in the papers, most whiplash patients fail to return for treatment once legal case complete. That says it all there, really. You don't even have to read the article. Most whiplash patients fail to return for treatment once legal case complete. Yeah. Compensation culture. And that other headline that struck me this morning was the one on the cover of the Examiner. Cases of Lyme disease soar in Cork, Kerry region. And they have a two-page special on ticks and Lyme disease in the Examiner today. And it's on the increase. There's no doubt about that. And the reason it's on the increase is because the number of deer in the country is on the increase. Seemingly, deer are far more efficient meal providers for ticks than cattle or sheep. Owen Healy, who's an expert on the thing, says the numbers of ticks found on an individual deer may be 100 times that seen on a single sheep or bovine grazing in a tick-infested habitat. Also, rising temperatures and an increase in annual rainfall are also helping to grow the tick population in Ireland. And the problem with Lyme disease is that people can mistake it for something else, like summer flu or chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia, and it's difficult to diagnose. And that's part of the problem. And it's a horrible, horrific disease when it's at its worst. I have an itch on the back of my neck now, and for the last few weeks, and I'm fearful that it's a tick bite. I'm serious. I'm not a hypochondriac, but it's there and it's not going away. But anyway, I'm sure it's innocent enough. I hope it's innocent enough. Speaking of innocence, we all do this. We all tell our children white lies, don't we? You know, the shop's closed. There's no toys left in Smith's. All that sort of thing. The ice cream man has no ice cream. Seemingly, we think that these are harmless. But now they've done research in Singapore with 379 young adults. And they're saying something different. Parenting by lying can seem to save time, especially when the real reasons behind why parents want children to do something is complicated to explain. And this is the crux here. When parents tell children that honesty is the best policy, but display dishonesty by lying, such behaviour can send conflicting messages to their children and mess them up in future years. But what if they don't know you're lying? You know, that's not the whole thing, that they don't catch out. You know, it's fleeting. Saturday afternoon, can I get a toy in Smith's? No, it's not open. That's it. It's done. It's forgotten about. Move on. Now, if you get to a stage where you're still telling your children lies in their teenage years and they cop onto it, then I can see how it might have a long-term negative effect. But little white lies to a 7 or 8-year-old, I don't think that's harmful at all. This is the thing that I've noticed myself. So I have one of these things in the car. I got a new car a couple of years ago, and it has all sorts of modern connectivity. That's what they call it. Connectivity. I'm connected to the world. And the thing, Siri or whoever it is in the car, will ask me, who do you want to call? Ghostbusters, no. So when you press the phone, it says, who do you want to call? And you can say it. So you could say John or Pat or Michael. And I always say please at the end of it. I'd say, John, please. Darren, please. And I just think that's nice. And I know Siri or whoever it is in the car is just some algorithm, computer, voice thingamajig, but it's nice to be polite, isn't it? It's nice to be nice. So now neuropsychologists agree with me. They're saying when you're speaking to Amazon's Alexa or any other thing like that, you should say thank you and please. Well, parents should anyway. Neuropsychologists warn that parents should start to treat the voice assistant with a little more respect by getting into the habit of saying please and thank you when making commands to avoid raising a badly behaved child. Dr. Laura Phillips, from the Child Mind Institute in the UK said there is a broader movement towards communicating through and with machines rather than people, which is a different style of communication. It could be dangerous if we do not make sure that children are developing the social use of language and that we pay attention to how we convey messages and understand the impact of our words on people, like please and thank you. It's back to Alain de Botton again. He was saying that politeness and kindness, things that we should reconnect with, re-recognise, rekindle, re. The only problem with I find sometimes is when you say please at the end of a name or a word or whatever, that the computer puts it all together and they give you something that you didn't want. So sometimes to get the message across, you have to leave out the please and the thank you. So that's a problem. Maybe they could work on that so that Alexa has to hear the word please, just like parents, before she'll do anything. And the other way you do that, can I have an apple? And? No, just an apple. And? You're looking for the word please. What's the magic word? Abracadabra. No, it's please. Please. Yeah. There's no surprise. Snoring is the most annoying bedtime habit, followed by duvet theft. Duvet theft. Yeah. That sounds like a criminal offence. Yeah, snoring. My heart goes out to anybody who snores, who has a partner who snores. I can't imagine what it's like. And if anybody could come up with a fail-safe cure to snoring, they would be very rich people. Loads of people have made claims over the years, and we've tried them out here on the programme. There's been books and rings and pillows and all sorts of things, potions and lotions, but none of them are fail-safe, and none of them cure the snoring thing for everybody. It must place an awful lot of pressure on a relationship. The research is done by the Hastings Hotels Group. Of course, they have skin in the game. They want people to have a nice night's sleep when they're staying in their hotels. They found out snoring. Then duvet theft, that's when one person rolls over and brings the duvet with them and leaves the other person exposed. Of course, the answer to that is, and you can't do it in hotels, they have separate duvets. Other grievances include partners coming to bed late and using screens in bed. That's a big one. Put your phone away. Some couples have a no phones in bed rule, which might be a good idea. Other annoyances in the bedroom were partners pretending not to hear the children during the night. I've never done that. Playing videos in bed and waking them up to say they were snoring. Well, I can understand that. You're snoring. Keep me awake. Despite all of that, 42% of people surveyed said they prefer to have company in bed. 24% said they like it all to themselves. So that's 42 and 24, which is 68. What about the other 32%? I don't know. We spoke to Kirsten Chadwick over the last couple of weeks, and you'll know Kirsten's story by now. Her fiancé, Kim, was diving around the Lusitania off the coast of Cork. It was supposed to be his last bucket list dive. He's an experienced diver, dived all over the world. Something happened. They still don't know, or if they do, they haven't told us. Something happened when Kim was coming back up from the wreck, and he has ended up paralysed. He was treated very well over in Galway, and Kirsten came on and told their story. They needed to get the money to get Kim back to their home country of Canada, and they did that with your help. They couldn't have done it without you, because an air ambulance is a very expensive thing. Well, Kirsten has been on to us, to ray@rte.ie. She says, hey, thanks so much. We are home. Who could have thought this would have been possible so quickly? We are so grateful to the listeners to the Ray D'Arcy Show. So thank you, thank you, thank you. Kirsten says, I cannot say it enough. I need a new word for thank you. You guys are everything. Canadian media wants to cover us going home, but Kim and I agree, this is Irish news. This is an Irish story. This is Ireland's celebration. Last night I sat around with family and friends and we all said, it was Ireland, and everyone knows it, everyone. As we took off, air traffic control in Shannon wished us well in Kim's road to recovery and said they were following our story. Like a movie. Thank you, Kirsten. Until she comes up with another word for thank you. Isn't that lovely? So thank you on her behalf. You get the message, thank you. All those who went on to the GoFundMe page and donated a fiver or 20 or 100 or whatever it was. 51551 ray@rte.ie. When I was a child, my mother would say, passing a toy shop, things in there are dear and there's no tick. First two topics covered. I haven't heard that in a long time. No tick. That was credit for those of you of a certain age. So if you're given tick in a shop, you could get things on credit. We were all told we arrived under a head of cabbage. Are we all damaged? Right? Some of us parents don't lie. I valued the trust with my 6 children from babyhood. That's Monica. Never lied. Never, not even a white lie, Monica. Ray, in reference to white lies that parents tell to their children, the parents should be reported to either the Tooth Fairy, the Easter Bunny, or if it's a blatant lie, directly to the man himself, Santa Claus. And then they'll be rebuked. Oh, for God's sake, can we just be parents without having to constantly be barraged with don'ts and do's and all that? This maddens me. Let us parent, says Julie. I'm just sharing the research with you, Julie. You can do with it what you wish. I lost my mum recently. I became very close to her after my father died 20 years ago. But just a message to people who still have their parents, get to know them, spend as much time as you can with them, and most of all, hug and tell them that you love them. And thank you, because one day they won't be there. Gary, thanks for that. That's a lovely message. That's a lovely message. Thanks, Gary. Mind yourself. I remember Ulaagh O'Connor and Ted Bonner on panels, and it was the reality show of Good Cop, Bad Cop, as they would differ over most things. R.I.P. Ulaagh. And may he rest in peace. He had a wicked sense of humour. Recall himself and Ted Bonner on The Late Late with Gay. Used to cringe at times, but great memories. And I thought I was the only one saying please and thank you to Google. It's just natural, but folk do laugh. Miriam Fitzmorrison. You and me, Miriam. Last bastion of politeness. Wherever I ring TV quiz or Ryan's Late Late one, I always say thank you when the computer voice at the end says thank you for ringing, etc. That's Reg. Reg, I met Eileen over the weekend and I was in a supermarket and I came out and said, I was waiting for you here, Reg. I just want to say thank you because I won €5,000 on your Saturday night show. Now, it's not my €5,000. And she said, it was the night that Marty Pella was on and you said, say hello to Eileen. And Marty Pella said, yeah, my wife's name is Eileen as well. And so Eileen was loud herself. So hello, Eileen. Ray, I never got a chance to watch your chat show, but I watched the repeat last night and really enjoyed it. Some great guests on it, Ed. Well, yeah, there you go. Spread the word, Ed. Spread the word. We had Rory Cowan and Brona Gallagher and Reg D. Hunter and Jarlath Regan and David Gray. And we had a Skype that didn't feckin' work. And Skype is dead to me now. It's dead to me. We were surprising this man down in Sydney. He thought he was on a shortlist and we were surprising him because he won a competition to come home. Currency fair, giving €30,000 to somebody to come home because seemingly it's very expensive to come home now with rents, car insurance and all that sort of thing. So they thought it'd be a good idea and it is a good idea. So he was waiting to hear if he won or not and we had his family on the couch. Teresa, Pauline and Peter and Jarlath Regan was there and we were going to surprise him on Skype and we had all the audience in on it and it was great. And on cue... Hi, Phil. Phil's his name. Phil Cahill. Hi, Phil. You're coming home. And then it cut to Phil on Skype. And he's just there staring at his computer because Phil couldn't see us or hear us. So we did it about 15 times before Phil finally realised that he'd won the competition. Then he was too emotional to say anything. But that's live television for you. I wouldn't have it any other way. 51551, RayRTE.ie. Good afternoon. There you go, Sufjan Stevens and Chicago. And why today? Because I was watching The Politician on Netflix over the weekend and that's the theme tune. It was also used in Little Miss Sunshine. It's lovely, beautiful. Pity I can't play the full 6 minutes. Why can't I? Why didn't I? I don't know. 51551, ray@rte.ie. I was watching Raised by the Village again last night and I cried again. It's very moving. You know the idea, they take 2 children from an urban area and bring them out into the country with a sort of a host family and they stay there for a week and they follow them and they see how they get on. And and Stella O'Malley is wonderful in it. And it's well worth a watch. 6:30, RTE1 of a Sunday. Now, on saying please and thank you to Alexa and Google and all those things, when I ask my phone... to ring John, please. It comes back. Do you mean John Cleese? Terry and Listu and Varna. And of course, you don't have John Cleese's number, Terry, do you? My husband travelling in the car with his 80-year-old mum said to Google Siri when she kept reminding him to turn right, okay, I know I have to turn. At which point, his 80-year-old mum says, don't speak to that girl like that. That's not how I reared you. It's great, isn't it? And the snoring, I snore very bad, so bad that even though I'm alone, it gets so bad I have to go into the spare room in the middle of the night. Hey, but don't. A snore machine is the only answer to the problem. I recorded my husband snoring. He sounded like a calf. I played it out in the garden and the cattle in the field reacted to it. But what's a snore machine? My husband is a wagon for the snoring, especially after a load of porter, and don't mention the farting. Mary in 2 Mile Boroughs. Well, Mary, seemingly in that survey, people rated the snoring worse than the other thing, the farting. My mother has a small mirror in the kitchen. It was in the kitchen window, and she used to see us acting up, and we couldn't understand how she knew, and she convinced us she had eyes in the back of her head. Very clever. I count my husband's snores, and I'm asleep in no time. Hopefully someone from Amazon and Google will be listening to this. Could they allow a parental setting on their home assistants to switch on a good manner setting whereby answers will only be given if you say please and the device will say you are welcome if you say thank you afterwards? Lovely idea, Eamon. I started, but you sort of put finesse on it. I remember Ulrich O'Connor on The Late Late. He was originally a bus conductor and boxer. And he had a great interest in Brendan Behan. He did. I see on the RTE archives, they've dug out him talking about Brendan Behan. And he was a playwright and he was a journalist and he was loads of things. The late Ulrich O'Connor. I use Amazon Voice and always say please when asking it to ring a number. But she never says you're welcome. There's not one person out there that has not told at least one white lie. I don't think it's possible not to. Things change and adjust, which doesn't allow for everything perfect. Watch The Invention on Lying. Brilliant. The Invention of Lying. I think I've seen that. My husband asked Satnav for a direction and he just wasn't getting anywhere. He said under his breath, are you stupid? And the answer came back, I'm doing my best. That didn't happen. We all had a good laugh at your show and had a lovely night on Saturday night. That was Jackie from Wexford. Well, you were very welcome. And you got your yogurt, your month's supply of Glenniskie yogurt. 51551 on RaidRTE.ie.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now we're joined in Studio 10 by country music star Sandy Kelly.
Hi Ray, thank you for the invite.
A long-time friend of Brendan Grace and well-known snorer.
According to Philomena Begley.
She outed you?
She outed me live on The Late Late Show, yep.
How did that come up in conversation?
Because we always share a room. If we work together,
yes.
Because we're such great friends, we share a room. And she just kept going on and on and on over the years about my snoring. And then one day, thankfully, she not able to work a recorder. She tried to record me on her phone while I was asleep. And we're on The Late Late Show and she outed me. So yeah. Every person I met for the next month talked about my snoring.
Have you tried to get it sorted over the years?
No, sure, I'm single. Why would I bother?
Okay.
So I'm not annoying anybody except Philomena Begley. Yeah. And I don't intend to marry her, so.
Right. And she probably deserves to be annoyed a little bit sometimes. Yeah, yeah.
She's great. By the way, wishing her a speedy recovery. You know, she had heart surgery in May. So wishing her all the best. She's one of my best buddies.
Great, great. And she is recovering.
Oh, she's recovering very well, but just has to rest.
Yeah, okay. Now, people who tuned in to Brendan Grace, thanks for the memories last week, would have seen you.
Mm-hmm.
You were out with the Forget Me Nots choir and you sang at the concert, so we'll talk about that in a moment. But first, just let's talk about your friendship with Brendan. It goes back a long, long way.
A long way. I can't even remember the first time that we met. The only way I can pinpoint a time, it was prior to 30 years ago, when he had the show live from the Olympia. And I would have been one of the guests on that show with my band live. And then we just started a friendship. And to be honest with you, he was probably closer and more friendly to my late sister, Barbara. And they had a wonderful friendship. Down through the years.
And Barbara was a singer as well.
Barbara used to sing with me. She was on my TV show. She did the Eurovision 1982. Mm. And she was very much part of everything I did. And so she would have worked with Brendan anytime I did. You know, she would have been there. But then he started calling to the house. He'd come with Brian, his road manager, if you like. And one of the memories I have of him is years and years and years ago, if I wasn't working, he'd call to the house and he'd stay over en route to somewhere or up on the way back. And my house wasn't very posh, Ray, compared to Brendan's house, you know. And one of the nicest things he did that I remember was he sent Brian to get takeaway cheeseburgers. And back then, there was no such thing as takeaway cheeseburgers, you know. And I remember that. And I can't remember how many Brendan had, but it was several.
Right.
Mm. And I remember if his van was parked outside our house, you know, it was like Elvis was staying in our
local. Because he was so popular.
He was huge.
Yeah.
But what a kind, wonderful man he was. I mean, he reached out to so many people.
And I was saying that any time we mentioned him on the radio over the years, you'd get a little handwritten card, a couple of weeks later.
Oh, wow,
saying
yeah.
thanks for the mention, you know.
Very few
Butler
people do
Brendan.
That.
Yeah.
And you know, the other person that I would have remembered doing that was somebody I worked with a long time as well, George Hamilton IV. And he believed in real mail, not email.
Yes.
And he did the same. And after Barbara passed away this week, 1 year ago, Brendan sent me a lengthy, beautiful, very comforting letter, just like that.
Mm. So this is a tough week for you. It's the year
anniversary. It's a tough week, but, you know, being... I'm so grateful that Brendan asked me to be part of this project. Little did I know just how special it would be in meeting the Forget-Me-Nots choir. Brian Redden, who's the producer. I don't know if you know Brian.
I know Brian,
what,
yes.
What yeah. a wonderful... I'd never met him. What a wonderful man.
Yeah.
And he had a great connection, almost like father and son, with Brendan. And I could see while we were filming and starting the project how much Brian looked after Brendan and cared about him. So although it's a difficult week for me, it's been a great week in a very nice way. I was hosting a luncheon yesterday for 350 ladies for breast cancer awareness. So I decided rather than sit at home, I would keep busy. And here I am talking to you today, and it's all, you know, it's all nice.
What? You know, Brendan, there's no doubt that he was one in, you know, 10 million. There was something
exceptionally
special about him.
I mean...
And it wasn't just that he could sing and he could make people laugh. There was more to it than that.
It was his heart and his kindness. And Eileen, his wife, is the same. You know, they're just wonderful people. And I suppose you might think it's an odd comparison, but I can only compare people as I meet them and as I've known them and been lucky enough to work with them. And he was so like Johnny Cash in his kindness and, you know, that different person who reached out and cared about other people. You know, wasn't really about the music. It wasn't really about the comedy. Of course, that was a great part of their lives, but it was who they were as people, as human beings.
And you can see, I know you haven't watched the documentary yet.
No, I'll tape it. It's just the week that's in it
in
and
it,
everything.
Yes, yes.
And even doing the concert the week before last was all...
All very emotional.
It was emotional, but it was great. You know, it wasn't tragic. It was great. And because Brendan and Barbara were so close, I think this is a lovely way to remember her as well.
And you've lost both of them within a year.
Yes. Yes, and it's a nice way to... They were such upbeat people. I want to remember them like that, as I'm sure everybody does. And interestingly, at the concert last week, you know, we were all like, oh, my God, how are we going to get through this? Because Brendan was there on screen from 30 years ago, thanks to Brian Redden, introducing us as artists. So I said, how the hell am I supposed to go out there and sing with the choir? What a beautiful world, you know. But he made us laugh all night from the screen. And, you know, he kept our spirits up and he was larger than life. Even his family, Eileen and the children, we were all laughing as well as crying, you know.
Mm.
And that's special, isn't it?
Yeah, and watching you last week, because you're featured and they show a clip of you from Live at the Olympia.
In
from all those
jeans.
Years ago in your skinny jeans. You were giving it socks.
That's what Brian Redden said. He said you were painted into those jeans. As you can see, I haven't changed much.
And that was live on a Sunday night.
Live on a Sunday night with the band and all. But your way back then, most things were live.
Mm.
When I had my TV series back in the early 90s.
Was that live too?
It was in front of a live audience. But there was no water cue.
Yeah.
And Brendan Balf used to write my links, and you know, I'm not the most educated person in the world. I certainly didn't have a college degree, so a lot of times I was asking people questions and I didn't know what the hell I was asking them. I just memorized it and just, you know, went for it, hope for the best. So everything's different.
So you were in the music business right from an early age, weren't you?
From the day I was born. I was carried on stage as a baby to be a baby in plays or sketches. And then from the age of 3, 7 nights a week, I sang, tap danced.
And your parents were in the business?
Yeah, Fit Up Roadshows.
Yeah, oh yeah.
You're too young to remember that, are you?
No, I know of them. We were talking to somebody about them recently, actually.
Yeah, and that was my life, the Dusky Family Roadshow.
We were talking to John Kenny about them, actually.
Yes, because he would have had an input as well.
Yeah,
we had a roadshow, my grandfather and grandmother and my father, his siblings, and all of us. And I toured with that show 7 nights a week as a magician's assistant, singer, tap dancer, part in plays, till I was 9.
Right.
And then I retired because the authorities came after my parents.
Well, for child labour?
Well, to get an education.
Yeah.
But sure, by the time I went to school in Ballintore, I could sell sand to the Arabs. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I was the most educated
person.
You've
been to the University
there.
Of Life, yes. Yeah.
I said, could certainly count money.
Yeah,
you know,
used
to take the money on the door with my grandfather, you know.
So you parked it then for a while and then went back to it?
Yeah, which was quite devastating, because I went from being in show business and looking at people smiling at me and clapping every night to my grandmother, who was wonderful, lived to the age of 106, but she ruled with an iron fist, and she decided she was going to, you know, chastise the singing out of me.
Right.
And send me to school and, you know, make me a real person.
That's a terrible phrase, chastise the singing out of you.
Yeah, well, that's kind of the way, you know, to do none of that singing now. And even right up to, you know, into her 90s, she'd say, are you still at that crack?
Right.
You know, because it was never thought of as a real job.
No.
And a real person. And of course, when my mum ran away with my dad and married him and ran off with the show, that was a disgrace. You know, she disgraced the whole family. Although they were poor themselves, my father's family were like somewhere less than that, you know.
Because it wasn't seen as a real job or...
No, and I think there was a stigma attached to living in caravans.
Yes,
and,
yeah.
You know, and some years ago, RTÉ done a documentary on me just prior to the TV series I had, and they asked me what would I like to call it. And I said I'd like to call it The Showman's Daughter, because that's what I was always referred to when I went to school. And so I went looking for my birth cert. I don't know why people do that. You tend to go back to that. And it says father's occupation.
Showman. Isn't that brilliant?
Yeah. Showman. So it made me sort of valid in a way to myself. And I've always been proud of where I come from and show fit up road shows. And
but
stuff.
Isn't it brilliant that you were part of that world that doesn't exist anymore?
Yeah.
It was a very different world, wasn't it?
I'm writing a book at the moment, which I took a little bit of time off after Barbara passed away. But I'm writing a book about that side of my history. And, you know, that's, to me, more magical than the years that came later.
Mm.
You know, having a TV show.
Well, I suppose everybody knows that. You know, the TV and people know that.
Yeah.
But the fit-ups is something that...
And they assume, funny enough, that when, say, I'm writing a book, that I'm going to write about that and about Johnny Cash and Willie Nelson and all of that. But it's not really that. It's about my childhood and the magic of that. Because although we were extremely poor and, you know, sometimes found it hard to have food, which many people did back then. I remember people paying on the door with eggs, fish, chickens.
Really?
Oh, God, aye, if they didn't have any money.
So they'd drive up to see a show with half
potatoes,
those eggs.
Yeah, potatoes. And I remember we were in Achill for 3 weeks and somebody brought fish and my grandfather hung it on the back of the caravan and forgot about it till it started to stink.
Is that anything to do then with that present that Brendan Grace got for Barbara when she was in
hospital?
Oh,
my goodness.
Is that connected?
He arrived at Sligo General Hospital just after we did the Eurovision.
Right.
1982. We'd had a bad accident. She had spinal injuries, was in hospital, a body cast for 3 months. And Brendan Grace arrives in. Honestly, Ray, you'd think Elvis Presley was in the building. I mean, he was such a huge star with this beautiful box all nicely parcelled and bows and everything. And I opened it for her because she couldn't. Her eyes were popping out of her head. And it was a box of potatoes, unwashed, uncooked. And just everybody started roaring laughing, you know. Just that was him, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that was him.
So you went to school and then you sort of reignited the showbiz career then at what stage?
Well, the first thing I thought might be a good idea was I joined the choir because my grandmother couldn't disapprove of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a very low voice, as you know. And the choir leader took exception to the fact that I couldn't sing in the same range as the girls. I always seemed to be singing with the boys. So that didn't go great for me. And so then I decided I'd enter the Fetches. And I had a wonderful musical teacher by luck in the National School, Miss Dowling Long. And she would keep me in after school every day to train me, to train my voice and how to use my diaphragm and stuff like that. And my first TV show she drove me to, I was 11, and it was Shoshagus Barkley. Do you might remember that?
No, I don't remember that.
It was an Irish programme, as you can imagine. And I was brought up here to the canteen at 11 and I saw all these people from TV and I couldn't believe it. I was going around my little autograph book and that was my first TV appearance. So I, you know...
First of many, I didn't realise that then.
It's like the night I met Johnny Cash, I never thought, I thought I'd see him once and that'd be it.
I can't believe it. Can I shake your hand? I shook the hand that touched Johnny Cash. What an amazing...
You're not the first person to do that.
Well, I won't be the last either. But what an amazing man.
Yeah.
What an amazing
but
man.
But there again, like Brendan Grace, very humble, very kind, did many kind acts for people without them even knowing it, you know, leaving money in... like wads of money in runners, in, you know, places to play and there might be a changing room and the kids, the teenagers would have runners and he just put money in the runners and, you know, acts of kindness.
Yeah, yeah.
And a wonderful man.
And those albums he did when he was, you know, close to the end.
Yeah. I've just actually come back from Nashville. I'm doing my first album in 25 years.
Very exciting.
I was sort of coaxed and overly coaxed by my son, Willie Kelly.
Yeah.
And it's co-produced at Cash Cabin, where I would have been all those years ago. Co-produced by Johnny's son, John Carter Cash, and my son, Willie Kelly. So that's a lovely project. It's to go with the book.
Yeah. And is it going to be originals, or will you be
some originals, some copies, but all of them...
Will you be singing crazy on it?
No. but you know, they redid a mix of Woodcarver, the one I did with Johnny Cash. And so funny. It was kind of nerve-wracking, really, because when we were in the studio, you know, he was always kidding about. And he was talking. We'd be talking to each other and messing about. There was never anything between us like that, but just kidding about. And didn't it come up on the recording, all the chatting?
All right.
And there's my son and his son, and I'm going, oh, my God, what did we say? I'm trying to think back. What were we talking about? Uh-oh. But anyway, they've left it on it.
I mentioned crazy, because I know Willie, your son, used to bring him on the road with you. And there came a point where he said, I can't listen to you sing crazy
He said to me, Mum, I used to bring Willie and his sister with special needs, Barbara, up until she was 18. And he said, Mum, I love you, but I cannot. He was my drummer. I can't play Crazy One More Time. And what makes you think my sister wants to listen to it one more time? So that was his way of sort of saying, and maybe it's a good time to mention Willie. He used to be with Rackhouse Pilfer. I don't know if you remember
them. Yes, I do, yeah.
And they were very successful. But just now, for the last 2 years, he's co-producing Sligo Live. I'm sure you've heard of that.
Yeah.
They've had this year, they have Joe's Holland, Des Bishop.
So it's a festival. It's a
huge festival. Starts at the end. I'm taking a week out to go to all the shows to be a groupie.
Right.
You know?
And so that's his job now, Willie's job.
It's himself and Rory O'Connor co-produced that. And it's a year long preparation and their 9-to-5 job. Of course, he gets to spend more time with my grandson, which is very important to me. And I'm looking forward to going on the 26th to the arena, the Knocknarea Arena, to see, I bet, one of your favourites, the Indigo Girls.
Oh, yeah.
Do you like the Indigo Girls?
Closer to Fine.
Closer to Fine.
What
oh,
an
my
amazing
God.
Song.
I'm going to be such a
groupie. We'll have to play that tomorrow.
Will you? I bet it'd be great.
The reason you're here is because I met you in the reception of the radio centre.
With Barbara.
With Barbara.
And her birthday.
And her birthday, yeah.
And her birthday. That was so wonderful, you know.
Does she mind if I say what age she is?
Barbara's 38, but does she look it? Not
no.
at all. But she lunged at you and gave you a big hug.
Okay.
Because she feels like she knows you, you see, because she's watching.
It was a lovely hug,
She gives the best hugs. But it was so funny. I was recording with the concert orchestra, as one does on a Monday, and they played Happy Birthday to her. So you have the RTE Live Concert Orchestra playing Happy Birthday, and all she does is roll her eyes up and go, oh, my God, you know, whatever.
You were saying she's special needs.
Yes.
So she's working at what level?
6 to 8 years old on a lot of subjects. We still have Santa Claus and all of that. But then on other subjects, I mean, she's very sensitive. She processes things in a different way than we do. Having a child with special needs is a gift. Sometimes miracles hide. And although it's a shock initially, it can make you a different family, a better family. Mm. We think kind of differently than, say, families with normal children, because we have to. But is it a challenge? Absolutely. It's a huge challenge every day.
And I was reading there that at 50 you had sort of a bit of a health scare.
Mm-hmm.
And it made you think differently about Barbara's future.
It did, because, we see, I think when you're a mother of a special child, and I'm only speaking for myself, you have a huge amount of guilt, because you go over. Barbara was born with a cyst in her brain, a third the size of her brain. And it wasn't diagnosed for about 2 months. And I went through an awful period of, what did I do while I was pregnant? Did I do, because I wasn't drinking, I wasn't smoking. But what did I do, you know? And I think mothers do that. They search themselves, their own souls first. And so I was very overprotective of her. When it came then to the time that I got sick, I almost had a stroke. From all the pressure, you know, I decided, well, what if I did have a stroke?
Mm.
What would happen to Barbara? And there are still many families out there, elderly parents, whom have our parent.
It's heartbreaking.
They have a child with special needs at home.
In their 50s.
I'm 65, almost 66. Some of them are in their 80s.
Yes, and what I'm saying is their children are in their 50s.
Yeah, sorry, that's right.
Yeah.
And what's going to happen when that parent passes on or becomes ill, or I become ill and pass on?
It's a big question, isn't it?
Well, I've given Barbara very reluctantly, because most, and her carers are wonderful. She's in the resource centre in Sligo, and they're wonderful. It took me a long time to trust anybody. And I would let her go in for one night a month. And after 3 hours of her being out of the house, I'd go and collect her. I couldn't trust anybody, you know. Now, you know, she's there today. She's listening to you, I think. And
hey, Barbara.
She's great. She's fantastic. And so it's wonderful because if something happens to me, she has her second family. Mm. You know, she has her second home and some independence from me. You know, not to be overprotective of her. And she's coming up to see me tomorrow.
I'm conscious now that she's listening because I'm interested to know how, you know, she would have dealt with Brendan's
loss. She was devastated.
And her auntie Barbara's loss.
Devastated. She processes death and grief in a totally different way than we do. And her way of processing it, first of all, she can't understand why it happened. Then she becomes very, very sad. She would go to my sister's grave on a weekly basis with her carer. She would cry a lot and talk about it constantly. Why? Looking for answers. Where are they now? And then she has this idea in her head that my dad and his second wife and my sister and Brendan and my mum, who was my dad's first wife, are all in a pub in heaven. And they're all having a drink.
Yeah.
And of course they are.
Yeah.
And they're all having a sing song. And so she has this, and she's very sad about it, you know, but she processes it differently. Am I talking too much?
No.
It seems like I'm talking a lot.
You're not at all. God, no. Sandy is a lady to her fingertips. She used to come into Beverly Hills in Castlebar and always brought a glow with her, says Siobhan. I have to say that the likes of Sandy and her showband colleagues and entertainers of their era are very humble. Thanks for all the joy. And what a wonderful lady, Sandy Kelly. She's coming to Mayo on 27 October to Ireland West Airport, knocked to launch the local parish Kilkelly Kilmovie magazine. Did you know that? You knew that,
right?
I did. We're all looking forward to seeing her.
Singing a few songs.
Yeah, that's is it best of luck. That's from Kilkelly Kilmovie magazine. Lovely to listen to Sandy Kelly, and so sad about her sister Barbara, as those of us who have lost a sibling can identify with her. She's a wonderful singer and entertainer, and wishing her the best of luck in life.
And Thank you so much.
You're still processing Barbara's death.
I am. I think the way I took 6 months off, and I think the way that I'm getting through it, as Sandy, Barbara's daughter, is a new CD. She only went back 3 weeks ago since her mum passed away. And of course, she moved in with me when her mum passed away. And she's doing drama and English, and she's a wonderful singer. My daughter, then I've got my grandson, Frank. I've got a lot to be doing.
Yeah.
And I'm busy.
Yeah.
You know, I'm off to Scotland next month on a tour, and then I'm off to Nashville to finish the album and on a tour for 3 weeks. So I'm hoping that I'm pushing it to the back somewhere. I hope that's not happening. Do you know how that can...
Yes,
you know, everybody asks
me,
are you all right?
And you think you're all right.
Yeah.
And then at some stage.
There's not a day coming up where like I'm going to... It's not that I don't cry and all of that. Of course I do. And I dream about her constantly. Mm. Constantly.
Mm. And you'll write about her in the book.
Oh, yes. Not the paragraph I wanted to write.
Yeah.
But of course, you know, because I'd already started writing about her, you know. But going back to the, if you don't mind me talking about the choir.
No, go on.
Because I've had a wonderful relationship with them, thanks to Brendan. And we hope to continue that on a very personal level.
And you're becoming an ambassador, and you're in contact with Laura Owen and all that,
I'm
which is brilliant.
I'm in contact with them, and they've made me an honorary member, and I have my scarf. And dementia, I suppose, I don't want to get into talking too much about it, because although my father had dementia, I'm not a big expert on it. But there is a play, if anybody is out and about, written, produced and directed by a guy called Tommy Marin. It's called The Three Marys. And it's touring Ireland. It's at Lowe on Wednesday. And they deal with this in a very unique and respectful way, but bringing that humour into it.
Yes.
That inevitably...
No, we had Rory Cowan on the show on Saturday night, and his mum died from dementia.
My dad did too, yeah.
Yeah, and he, you know, in the book, there's a paragraph on the early days of her dementia.
Yeah.
And it's actually quite funny, you know.
Ray, my dad was in a nursing home called Somerville in Strandhill, right on the coast where I live. And he was convinced that it was a hotel and I owned it.
Right.
Now, I could hardly afford to buy a house, never mind buy a hotel. And he would go around at night switching off the lights in the rooms and telling them Kelly was not paying
for the electricity. Yeah.
And then the other patients, dementia and Alzheimer's, he'd go around and tell them they hadn't settled up their account.
When
their family would come in, they'd be hell to play because they were thinking they were going to be turfed out.
Right.
Because that, so it does have an element of humour.
Yes, it does.
That's what gets you by, isn't it?
Now, I know you're taping the three documentaries. It started last week. The second one's on tonight. And tonight is, as I heard Brian Brian Redden actually on with Sean O'Rourke this morning saying it's a tough watch, and I've seen it and it is a tough watch because they were in Brendan's room 3 days before he died.
Yes.
And it's very tough. But yet it's uplifting as well because of the choir. And then next week, I think it's all the concert.
It's the concert, which is wonderful because, as I say, he's there, you know, larger than life. But also, as I was standing there looking, it's a variety show, which we never see.
Yeah, you don't see anymore.
There was comedy, there was sketches, there were songs from musicals, there was country music, there was pop. Mm. It was a variety show, which we don't see.
And the other thing that features tonight is Brendan's funeral, which we were at, and his four children spoke so eloquently, well. Like
so much dignity. Yeah. Eileen and the family, and you know, in a way, they brought us all to a level where we were all dignified.
Yeah.
And I mean, we lost Brendan Grace. They lost their father. Eileen lost her other half, her husband.
And I can't remember the daughter's name, which daughter
Ashling?
Was. But she said that he was a legend in showbiz, but he was a legend of a dad.
And I'm sure he was. You know.
Lovely to hear Sandy, lovely lady. We always enjoyed performing with her, Mary Burke and Crystal Swing. And great to hear Sandy on the radio. Remember the Dusky Road Show in Ballymote back in the 1950s. And can you ask Sandy what year she represented Ireland? You said it already.
1982.
Yes.
Yeah.
I danced on the Late Show as a young one and met her just before the Eurovision. And I'd love to know when that was, 1982. And Sandy is one of the kindest ladies I know. She is modest. And when I asked her to contact a friend who was ill, without hesitation, she agreed. She's an angel and a very darling woman. That's Nicole. And a lovely lady. Played the Seven Oaks Carlo on Sunday nights back in the day. Would spend ages after shows sitting in kitchen talking to staff. We've something in common.
That's our life.
I did the disco in the Seven Oaks for about 10 years.
Every Friday night. I used to do the Christmas.
There you go. We've something in common.
It's fantastic. You know?
So that was a real pleasure chatting to you, Sandy.
Oh, thank you.
Mind yourself.
Do you mind if I mention where I'm going when after I'm talking to you?
You're going to Castleblaney.
I'm going to see Raymond up in the Hooley in the Old Coach Inn.
Right.
And then Wednesday, we have a very special concert down in Navan in the Ardboyne with Jerry Guthrie, Olivia Douglas, a host of stars.
Right. So tonight, Castleblaney, and then Wednesday night in Navan.
The Ardboyne with Navan. With Jerry Guthrie. Thank you so much, Ray.
Sandy.
I enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it too.
Thank you.
The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Conor Pope joins us in studio. Big week for you.
It is.
With the budget.
Oh, yeah. It's like Christmas. It's like a really miserable Christmas. No, it is. The budget traditionally I started working in the Irish Times website in 1996, so it's a long time. And almost since the very beginning, the budget has been our really big day because there's always been a huge level of interest in it. And it's funny because you've seen the real roller coaster that the entire nation has been on, and you see it through the prism of the budget because back in the Bertie Ahern boom times, you know, people would be logging onto our website and we did kind of this budget calculator, and it would tell people in real time how much they'd be better off.
And it was like
people loved it because they were like, oh look, I'm going to be 700 quid better off this year, or I'm going to be 40 quid a month better off, or whatever it might be. And then of course the crash happened and people were logging on with great trepidation just to see how badly they were going to be worse off as a result of the budget, the swinging cuts in various budgets.
So neutral tomorrow probably.
I think that's funnily enough what most people want, because there's an awful lot of really, really uncertain times ahead. We don't need to talk about Brexit, but I mean, Brexit could be a complete nightmare for the economy, and and then you have very strange things happening in the United States, both economically and politically, and then you have strange things happening on continental Europe and Germany. So this is not the time for the government to be giving €20 to everybody, because like, it's not going to make any difference, those tiny little tweaks and taxes.
Yeah.
So I, you know.
Well, I could buy them a few votes, you know, but anyway.
And to be honest, I think.
Dare I say it, that politics in Ireland has matured a little bit more than that, has it, in the last few years?
Well, fingers crossed. I think nobody would thank them if they had some class of 1977 Fianna Fáil giveaway budget that sent the country spiralling into even worse economic into a worse economic crisis than we experienced last time out. Because I think the weird thing is, I think in 2007, 2008, I think a lot of people had forgotten what recession was, because we'd had this unprecedented boom that lasted from, not for everybody obviously, but for a lot of people, it lasted from the late 80s until 2008. And people forgot that when things got bad, they could get really, really bad. People haven't forgotten that now. Yeah, and people want, you know, steady as she goes, insofar as possible.
Stability.
Absolutely.
Right, we'll read this, we'll do a commercial break, and then you can give us the answer. Dear Connor, I bought an Adidas tracksuit bottoms on the 14th of September. This morning I put them on to find that the band of the joggers was not sitting properly and appeared to be faulty. I still have receipt and tag, so I called to the shop. I was told all they could do was send it back to Adidas and get it checked. I was hoping for a replacement. They said they could only send the pants to Adidas and see what they would say. They also said that because the tags were not attached, they could not refund. According to their policy, swing tags must be attached to garment. I proceeded to tell them that the tags came off, but was told again they had to be attached. I have two queries. Am I entitled to exchange or refund without pants having to be assessed by Adidas? And are the shop entitled to have a policy stating the swing tags have to be attached?
Well, it's not just pants.
Hey!
Yeah, I've been waiting all day to say that, Ray, so I'm glad you responded appropriately.
And we'll get an answer to both those questions from Connor after this.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Okay, Adidas tracksuit bottoms board, 14th of September. The band of the joggers not sitting properly. Receipt and tags still okay. Brought them to the shop. Question is, am I entitled to an exchange or refund without pants having to be assessed by Adidas, which the shop said? And are the shop entitled to a policy stating that swing tags have to be attached?
Okay. Well, this is fairly straightforward, and I get queries like this almost every week. Sometimes I get them several times a week, not necessarily to do with Adidas tracksuit pants, but like similar types of queries. And the reality is we have rights sometimes that we don't know we have, and then sometimes we think we have rights that we don't actually have at all. Okay. Now, there's a couple of things here. If this was me and the band wasn't sitting right and they were a pair of tracksuit bottoms, I'd probably just wear them.
Okay. But that's you.
An awful lot of the time, I in my own life, I would choose the path of least resistance.
That's not helpful for our listeners.
And the idea
Connor, but thanks for sharing that with
the
us.
The idea that I'd go back to the shop and get involved in a big row, it's just like, it'd be so tiresome. But the thing is, a lot of the time, people go into the shop and they're all fired up because they think they have rights that they don't have. Now, the reality is the retailer in this instance is doing exactly what the retailer should do.
All right.
Because if there's a problem with the product, the guy who works in the shop isn't technically qualified to establish what the cause of that problem is. So they can't really look at it and say, oh yeah, the band on the tracksuit bottoms aren't sitting right, we're going to have to, we'll give you a refund or a replacement or whatever it might be. So they do have to send them off to Adidas, and only the people in Adidas will have the technical skills to establish what the cause of the problem is.
But
so
I thought the contract was between the customer and the retailer,
absolutely.
And the producer.
So the contract is between the retailer and the person who bought the tracksuit bottoms. Yeah. But in these circumstances, the retailer has three things they can offer you. You have a right to a refund, repair, or replacement.
Yes.
Now, in this instance, what they've done is they've sent it off to the retailer has sent it off to the manufacturer to establish what the problem is. The manufacturer will probably say, this product is beyond repair, replace it. But that they'll have gone through the appropriate channels. Generally speaking, they don't offer a refund in any circumstances. Sometimes they'll offer a replacement. Yeah. But they're not under any legal obligation to offer you either a replacement or a refund before trying to offer you a repair first.
Okay.
Now, I can't imagine how much these tracksuit bottoms would have cost. If I'd been the retailer in question, I would have just said, let's just give this person another pair, because that's, again, the path of least resistance. Now, in terms of the tags, there is no circumstance in which this person is legally entitled to a refund, right? So if the retailer has terms and conditions that say, we will only give you a refund if the tags are attached to the product, they can do that because you're not legally entitled to the refund in any event. Right. So that could be an individual store-by-store policy. So because they don't legally have to give you the refund, they can impose all sorts of terms and conditions on how you would get that refund.
Right.
So I have seen retailers in the past where they say, oh no, I bought a coat not long ago and I took off the tag. Because it was raining, walked out of the shop and I said, oh, by the way, if it's not right, can I bring it back? And he said, no, you've taken the tags off now. And I was kind of going,
now, here's the thing, right? They obviously have machines that can replace the tags onto garments. I would imagine they do.
Absolutely.
The reason they're saying that is because if you wanted to wear it and then return it, you would remove the tags because you don't want the tag dangling off when you're wearing it out to your friends. So that's why it's there.
Exactly. So there's an element, like, even though this person is saying that I've never worn them, the tags just fell off them.
Yes.
The store has a policy in place where they say, right, the tags have to be on them.
And
otherwise,
I believe increasingly people are doing that.
Apparently it's a thing that you'd buy a fancy frock.
Yes.
You wear it to a fancy do. then you bring it back and say, oh no, it doesn't work, can I get an exchange or a refund, and you'll get your money back. So you can't go to your fancy do if there's a big price tag on it. So as a result, that's one of the reasons why retailers have that rule in place, and they are allowed to do that because they're not under any obligation to give you a refund or an exchange unless there's something wrong with the product. And if there is something wrong with the product, one of the first things they'll do is send it off to the manufacturer to be assessed, and that's what they've done. So the retailer isn't doing anything wrong. It's frustrating for the listener, but you just have to accept that these are the rules, and they're long established rules. And as I say, sometimes you think you have rights that you don't have, sometimes you think you have, sometimes you don't.
Exactly. The and on this occasion, it's the opposite.
It's the opposite.
Conor, thanks very much. Pricewatch@rte.ie. Pricewatch@rte.ie if you want Conor to grapple with any of your consumer issues. We're a bit late. Apologies. But Anish Toshinam, the Free Skelton, and Nogta, Lamora Breed, Nikulon. 51551 or ray@rte.ie. If you want to contact the programme on this Monday afternoon. I'm joined in Studio 10 by artist Al Hester, also known as Mazer. How are you doing, Al?
Hello. How are you?
And writer Conor Crichton. And we're going to talk about the Dublin Boys Club. Conor, how are you? I'll go to you first.
Good.
So you were involved in boys clubs in Germany and in the States.
Yeah, exactly. I started what is originally the Berlin Boys Club in Berlin, which is where I've been kind of living on and off for the last 10 years.
Okay.
And that was just a man's group, a place where boys could come, men could come, and just chat about their emotions and their feelings.
Okay.
And things like that.
There are rules. This is the brilliant thing. I didn't say it because I wanted you to say it. The two rules.
Yes. Well, the first rule of boys' club is don't talk about boys' club.
I think we veered off somewhere else, Conor.
No. The rules are very simple, and it was just to sort of distinguish the type of atmosphere and the conversation from other groups where men would talk. So the rules were just there was no booze and no banter.
Right.
So the idea was that it had to be a place where real talk happened, where you spoke. If you were making a comment, you said, I... It was personal. You didn't go, oh, I think men are like this. You would say, well, I feel that I'm this way.
Okay.
And it was a way for men to kind of practice vulnerability together.
And why did you do this, Conor?
I was just kind of bored.
No,
what happened is I think I was in a situation where I broke up with a person and I realized she had this amazing support group of women around her and I kind of didn't. And I thought, wow, there's something missing in my life. Why I don't actually have so many men who I can kind of lean on in these situations. And then just started from that, started to kind of extrapolate a little and saw that there was a lot of the boys who were in my circle on my football team, for example, people I worked with, they'd go through depressions and anxieties and they wouldn't share it with me or other people. And I thought this was kind of a failing in our communicative system. So I was like, well, why don't I start a club where we can try and do this?
Particularly male failing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not here. I can't really speak for women. Do you know what I mean? I think men have done that enough, haven't we? But sort of it felt like a situation where I could at least recognize amongst the men who I knew that we didn't really go to those deeper places so often.
Yeah.
And we were kind of afraid to be vulnerable in front of each other.
I understand the drink, no drink, that makes
yeah.
sense. And the banter, is that like slagging and sort of, is that uniquely male way of communicating? It's nearly like when you say, you call somebody a B-O-L-L-O-X, but it's a term of endearment.
Yeah, kind of, but also just sort of, you know, externalizing the conversations where we'll talk about football or we'll talk about objects rather than what's going on with ourselves. Do you know, where we'll kind of try and skirt around real topics.
Right.
And I think that was primarily what kind of the idea of like no kind of lad banter was.
What was the reaction from your mates?
Pretty quiet initially. Like I remember the first boys club I did, it was very funny. We did it in a friend of mine has a flower shop in Berlin. She let us use the flower shop after hours, so that was kind of funny. We were surrounded by chrysanthemums and posies and things, and it was just me and another lad, and we just, I said, all right, well, what's going on in your life, and we talked, and then slowly as it progressed, we get 10 people along, we get 12 people along, and lots of people even who weren't sort of coming still knew it was happening and kind of would appreciate it, you know, and sort of watch from a distance. And yeah, it just sort of grew. I think the biggest response was probably from women, though, you know, who were all saying this is amazing, thanks for fixing the man for us, and so on and so forth. And
so you're back in Dublin now. And yeah. You're mates, are you?
Good friends for a long time.
Yeah.
Long time.
So when Conor described the boys' club to you, Maser, Al, what did you think?
I can't remember the actual moment, but going backwards, we were friends years ago. Conor decided to move to Berlin, and I came over and visited the old time. Well, we shared friends. We go over, and then you were coming back. I set up a studio, and you came back, and we were obviously just watching each other from afar. And correct me, but you approached me saying you're teaching meditation. You could see that was ingrained in what I do, and my practice. And so we thought there was. We could work together in some capacity, and then from that, when we did that, Conor introduced the Berlin Boys Club, and I was like, bingo, there wasn't even any thinking to do it. Just perfect fit. We're like, yeah, and that's simply how it went. We're like, do you want to do this? Yeah, let's do it. And then we just started developing from there.
So what's your story? Conor has shared already that he went through a tough breakup, and he felt that there was nobody there to support him. So you had still have a very successful career, but was there a moment where you thought that you sort of burnt yourself out?
Numerous times, and that's okay. Like, that's fine. Burnt out, rebuild
creatively, or what?
Yeah, way? Even right now, I'd say I'm coming out of something now. There was a while there, I was like, whoa, I'm burnt out. I'm like, the concepts aren't flowing as much. The inspiration isn't there, and. The first thing that I sort of did was practice sort of patience with myself and that, and be like, because once you don't, you sort of, I feel for myself, I fall into a frenzy, and then you're not seeing clear, and you're sort of lost in that gun smoke a bit. So I sat back with it, and then I realised it was actually, I'm just doing this other parts of my life that I'm just focused on more, and they're coming up, they're rising up right now. So I'll entertain those in a way, and enjoy those.
Go on, like what?
Like meditation or training or... outdoor hill walking, different stuff like that. Looking at business maybe a little bit more. Like when I say business, I actually mean like the Tillier Studio, putting more time into that in the gallery and investing time into younger artists. And that, I found a lot of fulfillment in that. And coincidentally then, I found more purpose, because I was probably just a little bit off kilter with what I was painting. So I'm grand now. I took a step back from the painting a little bit. I still paint. Like, don't get me wrong, I was in Detroit 10 days ago painting. And I'm going to Florida next month to paint.
But and these are big outdoor things.
Yeah, big outdoor. But once I took that pressure off myself, then I was able to like evaluate a bit more, sort of step back. Yeah. Now that couple, you get that evaluation, that understanding as well from practicing meditation. And that's something that...
Before the meditation then, because the no drink is a big thing, and you...
it's such a shocking thing in Ireland, isn't it? No drink.
It's all right. But we've interviewed a lot of women about, you know, drink and how it was a big part in their life and now it isn't anymore. It's less often that you get to talk to men about that.
Yeah.
So have you taken a step back from drink?
I approach it differently, for sure. I've come to understanding that I used to treat it as a reward system. You've done great this week, and then you go and drink. And I found that there's a lot of habits there, like doing just repetition, and inherently after a while I wasn't getting happy, and then I sort of realised my actions weren't really aligned with my intentions, and so there's a disjoint there, and that caused, and I think this, I can speak for a lot of people, and I hear people talk to me, that disjoint will cause a lot of anxiety and uncertainty, and you lose focus on yourself. So once I reevaluate, sort of twisted around and reevaluated why I drink, and my actions then just aligned more with my intentions, if you understand.
So were you, I'm trying to tease that out there, so you said your actions weren't aligned with your intentions. Was this that you intended to do something, then you got drunk, and then your actions were
exactly
different?
You'd be like, the best, you know, you're all talk, okay, Saturday now I'm going to this, and then you fall into the old habits. I shall have one and two or three, and then you're disappointed with yourself, and you mightn't say it to anyone else, but you're disappointed with yourself, and that can build up over time,
and
next thing you know, I'm 38 now, you know, 38, I'm like, well, you know, I was saying this since I was 28 or whatever it is. That's not the case here with me. But before you know it, a few years go by, and then I just didn't want to be that person of like living too much regret, you know. So I thought it came to a point where I'm not speaking consuming alcohol, but came to an understanding of a point where I needed to take responsibility and ownership. And that's what I did. And that was a shift I noticed. Like, I don't know.
Do you think talking to your mates that they connect drinking with mental health issues, like with, you know, depression, anxiety?
I think that's a factor there for sure.
But do people connect it? Do you know that people speak about the fear on a Sunday night and they talk about recovering from a big weekend?
I can say from practice, yeah. Like, I don't drink as much as I used to, let's say in my 20s, and the fear isn't there as it was if I, you know, had a heavy weekend or something like that. And like, it's Monday today.
It is Monday.
I wouldn't be in here if I had a heavy weekend, you know, so... I would definitely have the fear of coming on radio and I'm full confidence and I feel good and we're excited, we're having a laugh coming in here.
Yes.
It's because I had a very wholesome weekend that I feel like I achieved a lot. And
do you know, say if there's, there won't be many, but say if there's guys in their 20s listening now and they go, well, you had your fun, it's okay.
Yeah.
You know, you had your fun. We all have to go through that to get out the other side and realise that maybe the drink thing isn't a positive thing.
Yeah, it sort of hurts me a bit when I just see people struggling and they're looking for an answer and they're sort of lost and there isn't really any guidance or answer there. And you can say, oh yeah, you just go through it. But why go through that either? If you can sort of coach or guide someone to sort of give you the shortcuts and be like, you know, you don't need to go through this despair or this self-doubt or questioning and destruction of healthy relationships and all these things that come with it. If we can sort of coach and show through, lead through a good example that...
Pass on our wisdom. The wisdom of experience.
Well,
is that part of what the boys' club is? What age are you, Connor?
I'm 39.
Right. Okay.
So not quite wise yet. You know, I'm getting there. But I think, you know, from living abroad, one thing that I would always recognise when I come back here is just how normalised the kind of dysfunctional drinking is to a certain extent, you know, and how kind of... You know, we how normal it is to talk about something like the fear, do you know, or how normal it is to talk about... no one says, like, how are you feeling? It's like, were you drinking last night? Do you know what I mean? It's just sort of these turns of phrase that have kind of fitted into our language.
Which doesn't exist in other countries, does it not?
Not to the same extent. I'm always kind of a little bit, and I suppose the longer I'm away and then the more I come back, the more kind of culture shock I experience when I come back here, and you're faced with that. And I mean, I worked for so many years as a barman in this city, and it was very, very normal to kind of... You know, drinking was something you did every single day and not to excess, but and then you come back and you recognize these habits and you see the kind of the how people can't commit to things so much, or how it's very difficult for people to be in social situations without alcohol and so on, and how much of a kind of a crutch it becomes.
Yeah. Right. So how do we change that?
Well, we create spaces, don't we, where it doesn't happen?
Because there are very few spaces for people to go where there isn't drink.
Yeah.
There are very few...
I don't agree with that.
Like, go on.
I used to think that, but like... And then they're like, oh, sure, you're doing nothing else. Or like, and then you're like, oh, you're missing out. Or what do you call it, FOMO? Or
FOMO,
you're missing out
so
many things. But then once you rework it and change it and don't use, as you said, drink as a crutch, it actually opens up all these other possibilities. So then I'm like, in situations, I'm like, I'm so glad I didn't drink last night because I would have missed this opportunity.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't have met this person. Now, it also comes down to you have to be responsible for yourself. Like, people will hold your hand and help you. It'll be that meditation or the Dublin Buzz Club might be that hand that'll help. But you have to walk yourself. You have to... not be a victim of your circumstances and just push on through. And then the reward is more rewarding as well. So, I mean, getting out there, like, it's like people say, I've lost my purpose. I don't know what my purpose is. I feel like you have to try loads of new things to find your purpose. So we're going up the hills, like, chatting, and I've found five new friends.
So you went up to Tick Knock on Saturday?
I went up Saturday, yeah.
I was teaching meditation.
Which is a group of lads?
Group of lads, yeah.
Right. And no booze and no banter.
No banter sounds tough. I just mean, like, they're not slagging, but like, there's definitely banter. Like, and then we're like, oh, is that too much banter? Connor was teaching a meditation workshop in my studio at the time on Saturday. So I went out and we had the Berlin Boys Club first in the studio, and there was a collection of maybe like 10 fellas like that, and it was amazing. And then we sent a group email and I said, here, what do we do next? And I said, I like going up the mountains, going for a walk. The walking and talking I find really easy.
Because you're facing the same way.
And you're just...
It's less intimate, you know.
Up being high or being in the woods, those blockers, I don't know what it is. It's much clearer thoughts and open conversation. So I said that and the guys came and then I put it up on social media and we got another few guys to come. And
what were you talking about?
Talking about all sorts. Like, it was more like getting to know each other. And as we said, like, it was loosely, I explained the rules from what Connor told me. And I said, these are sort of rules, and we speak about eyes. So it's just, we focus on that. Like, for the few hours, it's more introduction. We're getting to know each other. So we're personally talking about each other and we could see the crossovers there and the pressures. You know, the narrative there was like the unbalanced work life that a lot of us live. The conversation that we had first in the studio was primarily about drink and we're just exhausted of those old habits. So there was an alliance there with that. And yeah, up the mountains, it was definitely focused on.
And wanting to change those habits, those old habits.
Yeah, and I was just trying to say, like, right now we're doing it. Like, this is step one, because there's one or two guys there who were, a little bit more lost, you know. So they were looking for this, and I was trying to just say, you're doing it right now. We're here doing this. And then we were talking about, like, mental health, and I was sharing certain journeys that I had and their similarities. So there was no, like, professional coaching or anything like that. But just a shared experience, then you make maybe.
What's your mental health journey?
I come from a creative. I think you struggle with that quite a lot, and I did over the years. I was quite anxious at times, and I struggle with that quite a lot. You know, internally, like, you know, the conversation I'd have with myself would be quite harsh. And
your sort of inner critic, sort of.
Yeah.
I'm not
worst.
Achieving enough, or
I've been working on that quite a lot now for the last few years. But that's definitely.
How do you silence that?
I don't think you should silence it, because it's good for motivation, but it's just how you speak to yourself about it. So let that voice speak, but just change the tone.
Right. What about men? What about, you know, because they've been talking about now since the turn of the century, you know, that it's tough on men, because the lines of demarcation that were clearly, you know, there for our fathers aren't there anymore. You know, like, our dads went out to work, they were the breadwinners, they came home, you know, got the dinner, read the paper, farted, went to bed and did the same the next day, you know. You know, but there wasn't much expected of them. Whereas men...
That's quite a lot.
What? No, I mean, they, you know, they weren't expected to be that touchy-feely, whereas men now are supposed to be all things to all people. Do you feel that pressure at all or not?
I would want to be that, more so than feel the need to be. And I feel better as a person to be able to... That's in me. I feel that's in me. So I think it's in all of us and all these, if you look at them as separate attributes, it's just about bringing them out and having the confidence and courage to do that. Because if you suppress it, it might come out in other wrong ways.
And what about vulnerability and being a man?
Well, you notice the thing with, say, that with the boys' clubs, and we run them as well in particular, is the one thing that kind of the men seem to really crave is this idea of connection and a place where they can be vulnerable and without the repercussions of vulnerability. Because I think for most of us, you know, growing up as young lads and so on, if you're vulnerable in the schoolyard, you're the one who gets bullied. Or if you're vulnerable in the workplace, maybe you don't succeed so much.
Now, hold that thought, because I forgot we have a break to take. I was so immersed in the conversation, so we have a quick break to take. I'll chat to you after this.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Apologies to everybody, to Connor, to Al. You're coming again. We'll chat more.
Yeah,
you will. We're down the boys' club, and I'll give you information tomorrow. Sarah McNerney's on the way. We're back tomorrow. Enjoy the rest of your Monday. There we go.